Do you ever get that feeling when you look out over the sea, with its rolling blue waves and dark depths, that there's a whole other world beneath its surface? It can be easy sometimes to think that being on land automatically separates us from the water. But what if there are animals in the ocean already communicating with you? You just aren't listening.
The grunting of a fish, the snap of a shrimp, the scratch of a lobster. These kinds of bits of information can tell us not only about who's there, but what they're doing.
For artist Dana Fiona Armour, it's animals like the sea snake, a vital but often neglected bioindicator of marine health that can be a crucial lens to environmental change. In a time of climate emergency, with fragile ecosystems, rising sea temperatures, and decreasing salinity, Dana asks, what would it take to retune our ears and listen to the sea snake?
The sea snakes invite us to listen to non-human, non-anthropocenic rhythms, such as temperature shifts and chemical changes in the water, but also the patterns of movement beneath the surface. We're very focused on us and our world, and when it comes to oceans, it's so far away from our world that we can't really project ourselves.
In her major courtyard commission for 2026, Serpentine Currents, Fragments of a Changing Future, Dana visualizes how marine ecosystems are degrading and changing. The installation blends sculpture, science, and responsive light technology, translating complex research and predictive ocean data from the British coast into visuals with the sea snake at its heart. The dataset is also projected 50 years into the future, in a world where warming seas might allow sea snakes to inhabit UK waters. By exploring the ways the sea snake's existence is being threatened, how might artists and scientists collaborate to tackle these ecological issues at large?
Yes, our oceans are warming, and also the British coast is going to get warmer and warmer. Collaborating with artists, we can actually reach like a whole other section of the population. We can reach people that we would never reach otherwise.
This is The Process. I'm Laurent Jean, program producer at Somerset House Studios. In this episode, we delve into the ideas and urgent questions surrounding Dana's installation. Joining us are Anthony Herrell, researcher at French CNRS and the Natural History Museum in Paris, and marine biologist and musician Heather Spence. If the sea snake is telling us that the oceans are collapsing with devastating consequences, then what does the future of our coastlines look like? And how can we learn to listen better?
You care about biodiversity, you care about saving the planet, you care about the sea snake, right? My name is Dana Fiona Armour. I'm an artist based in Paris. Well, I would actually define myself as a sort of artist and researcher, as my practice combines art and science. It's often conceived in collaboration with scientists. And then there is a more classical part to my practice, meaning sculpture and installation blended with new technology and light. So its content is about like the how the ecological breakdown may reshape a relationship between species and matter. For me, like all species matter, human beings, well, should be all at one level. And I think we have to rethink our anthropocenic worldview. So the installation is called Serpentine Currents, Fragments of a Changing Future. So it's a large-scale sculptural installation placed in the courtyard fountains of Somerset House. It's a deconstructed modular sculpture of a sea snake. So the shape is based on a 3D scan of a specimen being part of the collections of the Natural History Museum Paris. It's been divided into a triptychon, and we have a LED mesh placed inside each of the sculptures. And this LED mesh is animated by oceanographic data drawn from sensors placed on the British coastline, drawing from 50 years of recorded sea temperature and salinity that's been projected into the future 50 years. and being retranslated by light patterns such as speed and light intensity. I want the viewer to feel like the agitation of the sea snake, like being exposed to warmer and warmer waters, decreased salinity. I want to know how the future of coastlines look like. And I want to know if we can learn how to listen better to even those that we can't understand or might not be able to understand. Maybe if we try harder, we will.
Are humans effectively impacting these animals in these marine environments? Is there a way we can make people aware that these animals are actually very important and can document the changes that we are imposing onto our environments? My name is Anthony Harrell. I'm a researcher at the French CNRS, which is a French research foundation, and I actually work at the Natural History Museum in Paris. So when we think about sea snakes, we think about snakes that actually live in marine environments. And what's really interesting about sea snakes is that there's actually three groups of snakes that have independently radiated into this environment. So we have the true sea snakes, the ones that we typically think about, that really spend their whole life in water. They almost never come onto land, and they're actually really poor at moving on land. You have a second group, the sea crates. Those animals actually go to land pretty regularly. They lay eggs on land, so they live part of their life on land. And they're actually pretty good also at moving on land. And then there's a third group. It's a group of snakes in a family called, in the Latin name, Acrocordus, also called elephant trunk snake. They're really bizarre looking animals. And one of those actually went back to the marine environment and lives in salt water.
They have such a delicate way of moving. Like, you can't hear them moving through the water. They're like flying, you know, like sliding.
These animals are actually amazingly, like, elegant. So if anybody's ever been able to go diving in Southeast Asia, you may have seen them, actually. And they kind of move through water in a very fluid, continuous way. So they use these undulations of the body. And when they're swimming, you actually don't almost hear nothing. It's very quiet, it's very silent. It's because they're so good at swimming. They're not creating turbulences. And it's this turbulence that you potentially, like a propeller on the water, it makes a lot of noise because it's actually turbulent flow around the propeller. So these animals are actually keep the flow, what we call laminar. It's kind of smooth across the body. And so they actually don't make any sound on the water. And in this marine environment, they're actually on the top of the food chain. They're eaten by very few things because they're poisonous. Everybody leaves them alone. And so they fill this role of kind of a top predator in the food chain. And so these top predators are really good indicators of the ecosystem health, so the health of the whole kind of environment that these animals live in. Something goes wrong with the fish or something goes wrong with marine invertebrates, then the fish that eat those marine invertebrates are going to be impacted. And the sea snakes that eat those fish that eat the marine invertebrates are going to be impacted. And because they're at the top of the chain, they're actually the first ones that may show these cascading impacts from just water temperature changes to like an animal that's not doing well in this environment. And because they're at the top of the food chain, they're actually really good bioindicators of what's going on with the health of our oceans.
The sea snake is this kind of not very visible, not very like in your face example of this key part of the ecosystem. And we can think about other creatures that might be overlooked and yet have this really important role to play in the ecosystem and for our understanding of the ecosystem. I'm Heather Spence. I am a marine biologist and musician and composer based in Arlington, Virginia. So what are the kinds of sounds that we might be hearing? So there might be individual voices of individual creatures. So you might hear the grunting of a fish, the snap of a shrimp, the scratch of a lobster. And these kinds of bits of information can tell us not only about who's there, but what they're doing. And so we get some information about biodiversity because we're hearing the sounds of different species. And so when we hear that sound, we know that that species is there. But even more than that, we know something about what that species is doing because they're telling us something through the sound that they're making about their behavior.
And so understanding these animals in their environment is something that I think is critical for us to think about how we, that also are part of the same environment, are impacted by the changes that we ourselves are imposing into our environment. So listening to this natural world and seeing how they respond to the changes that are going on is telling us something about how we will potentially respond to these changes. We see animals going extinct at a rate we've never seen before right now. Sea snakes are part of that. Several species are on the most endangered category of the IUCN Red List. So animals, we are losing biodiversity, but we are part of this biodiversity. And if we don't pay attention to the loss of this biodiversity, we may lose ourselves as a species. I mean, this is a real potential risk. So this natural world is like an indicator. It tells us something about the health of this planet and also the health of human beings living in this on this planet.
Caring about the sea snake is also a way of acknowledging that the oceans are actually collapsing right now, and it's happening already. And the consequences, they reach really like far beyond just a single species.
A big part of this these days, we're tracking temperatures of the water, and there could be events where the temperatures are going quite high. And when that happens, we see the changes in the ecosystems and the monitoring that we're doing. There was an event in one of the areas that I and my group that I work with are studying in Puerto Morelos, Mexico. And there was this coral bleaching event. The water temperature was very high and the corals were bleaching. And we got sounds of that bleaching ecosystem.
With coral bleaching, we lose the marine diversity. This is impacting the fish that live there, and this is impacting the sea snakes. And so we see this impact on populations of sea snakes. We see numbers decreasing over the past 10, 20 years. And species that used to be quite common, we see them less and less. So we are seeing these impacts of coral bleaching. Coral bleaching was its temperature effect. It's due to global warming, nothing less. Sea temperatures are rising, corals are bleaching. We lose the invertebrate diversity, we lose the fish diversity, we lose the sea snakes.
And that may impact the species that rely on the corals, and maybe some corals die, and maybe that changes the species that are there, but also like the architecture of the reef and the habitats that are there and their ability to hide from predators, and all of these things can escalate. And that can have far-ranging impacts. When you start to have the upset of the ecosystem, everything is interconnected. And when something gets too out of balance and things start sort of crashing and really having drastic changes, that's affecting not that just static ecosystem, but all the ecosystem around it, right? There's so much interconnectivity. Think about migrating species. Think about the chemistry of the water, the interaction of the water with the air. Think about the way that the bottom structure of the ocean along the coastline protects the shore. All of these things start to add up. And if you have a whole lot of changes, that can really upset things for humans in a very direct way that's really in our face.
I want to know how our coastlines might be looking like in 50 years from now, you know? I want to know what we will endure, what we can project ourselves to. And I want to know also if we can still save our coastlines.
So when Dana contacted me and I was talking about snakes, sea snakes, how important they are, also like what are the constraints on a sea snake, where can it live, where can't it live? And it's really interesting because sea snakes occur in tropical waters around the world. The only place they don't occur is in the Atlantic because the water's too cold. So you don't find sea snakes in the Atlantic Ocean. And so we were talking about water temperature. And then we started looking for, do we have data on water temperatures? And are there good predictions on future water temperature change? And since the artwork was going to be exposed in the UK, in London, Dana was thinking of like, maybe we can use data on the British coast and see if we can make some predictions whether global change may actually change these temperatures for sea snakes to be able to live in environments, the Atlantic, where they now don't live, so British coast. Could the British coast in the future potentially become habitable for sea snakes? And so we found this really interesting historical data provided by CFAS, long-term data from the Dover Channel, for example. And based on these long-term data, which really go back over 100 years, I was able to build a statistical model. So basically, just based on the data we already have from the past, the changes in these data over time for the last 100 years. And based on this, I made a prediction into the future. It's only based on what we already know. But surprisingly, when I predicted 50 years into the future and I compared it to predictions that are actually based on global circulation models, like very complex physical models, we end up with exactly the same prediction, suggesting that, yes, our oceans are warming, and also the British coast is going to get warmer and warmer. And if we go far enough into the future, this is actually an environment that could become habitable for sea snakes. If we imagine a future 50 years, 100 years from now, British coast, first thing you would see is like very different like organisms, mostly plants, algae. Algae are one of the first things, they grow very fast. We get algal blooms. Some of them are actually very toxic. So we might get massive die-offs first of the native fish that live there. But these algae would start growing. Following these algae, you get other plants that would colonize these environments. And then you would actually get migrations of fish that now live in warmer waters that would actually move to these places where before they couldn't exist. And then ultimately, in the last step, these top predators like these sea snakes could actually also inhabit these environments. It's hard for them to go around the tip of South Africa because it's too cold. But humans created the Panama Canal, which connects tropical waters in the Pacific to tropical waters in the Gulf of Mexico. And so we're seeing the first sea snakes actually going through the Panama Canal and going into the Gulf of Mexico. And from this Gulf of Mexico, they could actually, if the water's warm enough, cross the Atlantic and end up in the British coast. And it would have an ecosystem which is completely different from what we see now, which would be more like Pacific Costa Rica. Tropical fish, sea snakes, different plants. Potentially, if it's not too warm, even some coral growing.
For me, the world of science is just very inspiring because it's actually real. And I think it's a perfect combination, sculpture providing a sort of material presence, whereas science grounds the work in an actual ecological reality. And it's also a way of like bringing science to people who usually might not be in touch with it. And I see myself as a sort of like a translator between the two worlds.
The combination of art and science is really powerful for inspiring action, because then you start to have this crossover happening. And then it's not art over here and science over there. It's art and science working together, melding together. Questions are being asked. Emotions are being felt. And there is emotion in science, but I think it's one of these things that it is a little bit difficult to bring the emotion into science in the traditional way that science is talked about and done, because you want to be talking about things, you know, very objectively and not putting too much bias into it. But by bringing in the art, it's a way of making things more human, more personal, and more emotional in a way that is safe but also exciting. That can just open up new questions that can be asked and new ways of exploring questions that we have, but we're not sure how to explore them.
I think it's pretty complementary, and each part can draw something out of it, usually, like from my experience in the past. For instance, in my collaboration with the Natural History Museum, well, we were working on the sea snake, and I was very interested in its scales, because their work is like sensory scales, kind of feeling the movement of the water, but also prey approaching. And there has been really little studies done on that so far. So me, I was interested as an artist, but as researchers, they were really interested. So now we're actually kind of co-writing a scientific article on those scales and the sensory receptors on the scales. So I think both sides, they can inspire each other in a way.
Art is just a very fascinating way that allows science or scientists to communicate with a public that we rarely even talk to normally. Collaborating with artists, we can actually reach like a whole other section of the population. We can reach people that we would never reach otherwise to convey a message about the distance between humans and nature, about how humans are impacting nature, about the essence of being human, being part of nature, and all these kind of questions, which are essential questions.
The sea snakes invite us to listen to non-human, non-anthropocenic rhythms, such as temperature shifts and chemical changes in the water, but also the patterns of movement beneath the surface. We're very focused on us and our world. And when it comes to oceans, it's so far away from our world that we can't really project ourselves.
Sound can really affect us emotionally. And so the ability to hear the voice of the ocean, not just hear the voice of the ocean, but also be given the tools to understand something of the meaning and of that soundscape, that is a personal experience that anyone anywhere can have. And I say that too with the full knowledge that not everybody has full hearing ability, but we've also, the thing about sound is that it's also a vibration. And so it can also be felt. I think the sea snake and other creatures who are less visible or less heard, these are opportunities to listen to what's beyond right in front of our face, to take a moment and pause a little bit, to listen a little bit deeper, to think a little bit deeper about all of the different layers. It can be difficult, especially as we have so many things that are yelling for our attention more and more. And as those things get louder, the things in our environment have to get louder too, right? And the signs that are blaring at us, all of the sounds of our environment, all the more reason to like take a moment, right? Like just take a breath and put attention into noticing the little things.
I mean, if there's one main takeaway, it would be like pay attention to nature. We are part of nature. We are one among many species. We are one among millions and millions of species. And we cannot survive if we lose those other species. We are just part of this kind of network of interactions. Climate change, it is a very urgent matter. We have already passed the lowest scenario of climate change, global warming. We are losing biodiversity at a rate we've never seen before in the history of the planet. We have fossil records. We know there have been mass extinctions. We're losing species at rates which are up to 100 times faster than we've ever seen in the history of this planet. There's urgency. Is there hope? Yeah, there is hope. We still can do things, and everybody can do something.
If we become hopeless, that can lead to a different kind of decision making, because what's the use? It's very important to keep in mind that we, each of us, has the ability to make things better. Let's gather more information, and just in the process of gathering more data and then sharing it with others, getting scientists and artists to work together, things will appear. Opportunities will come out of that process.
Art can operate in a space of speculation and effect. It can transform data sets into experiences that provoke empathy or discomfort or hopefully even curiosity. And it's opening new ways for scientific research to be encountered as well and questioned by the big public, like by the wider public, and hopefully also, I'd say, emotionally understood. It has definitely changed my ecological awareness in the case of my residency at the Natural History Museum in Paris. But it also has changed my way of working and my attentiveness to how knowledge is actually produced. And I think it's very important to get the message out there and to get their research out there and make it accessible. The sea snake is one part of a bigger picture, equally important to the bee or the tree or, you know, the human being. I don't think there is any status variation between beings on this planet. Like, we're all equally important.
You've been listening to The Process. Thanks to Dana Fiona Armour, Anthony Harrell, and Heather Spence. This episode is presented by me, Laurent John. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. The producer is Tess Davidson. The theme music is by Carr Beard, and the series is mixed by Mike Woolley. Additional field recordings are from Heather Spence. The Courtyard Commission for 2026 is Serpentine Currents, Fragments of a Changing Future by Dana Fiona Armour. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.